Hello and welcome to this week's Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast, where we're going to continue our mini-series on Tolkien's philosophy of myth, using as our text his famous lecture, which was subsequently published as an essay, on fairy stories. And we've come to the section of the essay or lecture on recovery, escape, and consolation. And I'm going to work my way through it as we have done. He talks about a tree, or the tree of tales. So capital T for tree, and tales, capital T, but as in T-A-L-E-S. So if you like, the tree of stories. What you have to understand about Tolkien is that for him, a tree is an image or a symbol or a metaphor for tradition in its deepest sense. That basically a tree lives far longer, well, certain species of tree live far longer than men do, and therefore they are remembered by our ancestors as being in the same place. The longer they live, the deeper go their roots, the broader is the trunk, but always in the current season, the now, if you like, they spread out their glorious leaves. So they are always present and flourishing and are manifestations of beauty in the present, but they are only that because of the ages of tradition that they represent. So that there's that watch for the physical tree. Let me give you another example. Tolkien said about the mania in the 1960s for looking for the so-called purity of the early church. Somehow some idea that the church has decayed with age, and we have to get back to the purity of the early church. Tolkien said, "I do not see why a sapling is considered superior to the full-grown tree." And he said that even if the sapling were superior to the full-grown tree, if you chop down the full-grown tree looking for the sapling, you don't find the sapling, you kill the tree. Now, I'm paraphrasing him there, but that's basically what he's saying. So in other words, in the understanding of the ecclesiology, as the church has grown through the centuries, and it has that 2,000 years of experience. As Chesterton said, the church is the one continuous institution that's been thinking about thinking for 2,000 years. So this whole image of the tree, Tolkien has the same image in terms of philology, in terms of linguistics, that every language, indeed every word, is like a tree. Every word, it has its own family tree changes. First of all, the English will go back to, for instance, Middle English, and then Old English, Old High German, obviously Latin thrown in there, the different family trees of words. So he understands the tree of language, the tree of ecclesiology, the tree of tradition in the general sense, and the tree of tales. In other words, that all the stories told throughout the very long history of humanity is that long living tradition of a tree growing through the eons of human experience and human storytelling. This very notion of the tree of tales. And then he says, who can design a new leaf? Now, for those of you that have read Tolkien's short story Leaf by Niggle, this will palpitate with significance, but I'm not going to go on that tangent. Perhaps we'll have a separate series at some point on Tolkien's short story Leaf by Niggle. But the point is, we can't design a new leaf. We can represent the leaves that are already there. So he says, each leaf of oak and ash and thorn is a unique embodiment of the pattern. So here Tolkien is actually following, from medieval times, he's following the understanding of Hecataeus, at least poetically. There's lots of discussion amongst philosophers about the Duns Scotus's teaching on Hecataeus and whether it conforms with Thomistic understandings of being. But anyway, that's neither here nor there as far as this context is concerned. The point is what Tolkien is saying, if you like, echoing Duns Scotus, blessed Duns Scotus, and echoing the great poet Jeremy Hopkins, is that everything has its own HA attached, its own thisness, its own uniqueness. So each leaf of oak and ash and thorn is a unique embodiment of the pattern. In other words, that God does not mass produce like a machine mass produces. He doesn't replicate clones. What he does is to love individual beings into being. And so every individual oak tree is unique from every other individual oak tree. Every single individual leaf on every individual oak tree is unique from every other oak tree leaf. God loves things into being as unique works of art. Okay, so this is a backdrop to our understanding of creativity. Now I'm going to read this long paragraph and comment upon it. We do not need, or need not, despair of drawing because all lines must be either curved or straight, nor of painting because there are only three primary colours. We may indeed be older now, insofar as we are heirs in enjoyment or in practice of many generations of ancestors in the arts. In this inheritance of wealth, there may be a danger of boredom or of anxiety to be original, and that may lead to a distaste for fine drawing, delicate pattern, and pretty colours, or else to mere manipulation and over-elaboration of old material, clever and heartless. But the true road of escape from such weariness is not to be found in the wilfully awkward, clumsy, or misshapen, not in making all things dark or unremittingly violent, nor in the mixing of colours on through subtlety to drabness and the fantastical complication of shapes to the point of silliness and on towards delirium. Before we reach such states, we need recovery. We should look at green again and be startled anew, but not blinded, by blue and yellow and red. We should meet the centaur and the dragon, and then perhaps suddenly behold, like the ancient shepherds, sheep and dogs and horses and wolves. This recovery fairy stories help us to make. In that sense, only a taste for them may make us or keep us childish. Now, I'll start with the end paragraph. By childish here, he's meaning what I would call childlike. And I often distinguish between the childlikeness, which is necessary to get us to heaven, unless we become like little children, we cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven, as distinct from that childishness that St. Paul tells us that we need to put behind us when we become grown men. So that childishness is something very different from childlikeness. When here, Tolkien means childlikeness when he uses the word childish. So, but let's move back. First of all, this paragraph is a wonderful critique in a very few words of all the various nihilistic or at least relativistic movements in modern art, caused by ennui, by boredom with the beauty of the tree of creativity, the tradition of art which we've inherited. So he talks here about we become bored or have a distaste of fine drawing, so draftsmanship, delicate pattern, and pretty colours, or else we manipulate towards over-elaboration or of old material, clever and heartless. As Tolkien's always telling us, there's a huge difference between cleverness and wisdom. Being clever is not necessarily a good thing. He says actually in The Hobbit that orcs are clever. So he talks about the mixing of colours on through subtlety to drabness. I would call this a reference to Impressionism. And the fantastical complication of shapes to the point of silliness, I would suggest that he's probably referring to cubism, and on towards delirium, he's probably referring to surrealism. But before we reach these things, we need recovery. We do not need to go down that road of delirious darkness. We need to be able to see things afresh, anew, as if for the first time, to be startled by the familiar. But the only way we can do that is to somehow see it from an unfamiliar perspective, ultimately through the perspective of an innocence we've lost, of a childlikeness which we need to regain. And as he tells us, fairy stories, fantasy, such as The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and The Chronicles of Narnia and, of course, the classic fairy stories, have this power of recovery. Let's move on. I'm going to carry on reading. Recovery, which includes return and renewal of health, is a regaining of a clear view. By the way, he hyphenates regaining there to make sure we're actually looking at the word and not taking it for granted, not being blinded by our familiarity. I do not say seeing things as they are, and involve myself with the philosophers, though I might venture to say seeing things as we are or were meant to see them, as things apart from ourselves. We need in any case to clean our windows so that the things seen clearly may be freed from the drab blur of triteness or familiarity, from possessiveness. So here the key thing is, first of all, he's drawing deeply, I would suggest, here from the chapter The Ethics of Elfland, from Chesterton's wonderful book Orthodoxy, where Chesterton says that the ethics of Elfland is that it shows us what things ought to be, what things should be, not what they are. In other words, I sometimes use the example of Christ. Now, Christ is the perfect man. We are called to be Christ-like. Is it realistic to believe we'll ever be as perfect as Christ? No. But are we better the more like Christ we are? Yes. If Christ is the perfect human being, are we becoming more truly human the more like Christ we become? Yes. Are we becoming less human if we allow ourselves to become less childlike, less Christ-like? Yes. So this is what he's saying here, is that if you like, as with the gospel, which shows us how things should be and how we should be in the light of the perfection, which is God, or who is God, fairy stories show us also how things should be, in contradistinction to how perhaps they are. And that is inspirational and aspirational. So it inspires us to aspire towards something better, and that in itself is something which leads to a better world. I'm going to leave it there. We actually get, and when we continue next week, we'll get Tolkien continuing to talk about recovery and actually mentioning Chesterton specifically. So where I would suggest and have suggested he mentions Chesterton allusively in this discussion, which reminds us of a certain chapter in Orthodoxy next week. In our discussion of Tolkien's philosophy of myth, we'll see Tolkien actually overtly mention in tribute the importance of a Chestertonian understanding of things. So for the connection between Chesterton and Tolkien, or one of the many, but the one specific one, please do join me next week for the next of this series on Tolkien's philosophy of myth. And until then, thanks so much as always for joining me, and goodbye and God bless.